Increased oversight will be a top priority for new Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley. He says oversight can change the federal government faster than legislation. David Hawkins, the senior editor at Roll Call, looking at Chairman Grassley's plan for the Judiciary Committee and potentially what other chairs might have in store for the agencies they oversee. The one I'm particularly geeked about, as you probably can imagine, is the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. And I'm sufficiently geeked about it, David, to the point that I actually watched the organizational meeting, the business meeting last week, from the beginning to the very end.
I should probably interview you then.
Well, to see how Senator Johnson wanted to set that committee up. But you and your colleagues are reporting at Roll Call that Senator Grassley is already figuring out exactly how he wants to oversee the Department of Justice. What are we learning about what he has in store for that committee or agency?
Well, the first thing I would mention is that this is nothing new for Chuck Grassley. Chuck Grassley, who's been a senator since the middle 80s, sort of made his first headlines way back then. He was the guy who brought you the whatever that was, the $400 hammer and the $700 toilet seat, right? And that was his sort of initial claim to fame. So now he has this gavel, which he's been waiting for a long time, and he's promising to hold, to hold the administration's feet to the fire. And this is in 2 years in which the president's a lame duck and the Republicans may or may not get anything legislatively enacted. You know, it's an old formula that if one party controls Congress and the other party controls the White House, the party that's controlling Congress uses its oversight powers to make the president's party miserable.
So it's reasonable to assume then that Senator Grassley won't be unique in doing a heavy oversight agenda in this Congress. We should expect to see this across the committees in both chambers. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. You know that the you mentioned Senator Johnson's committee. It'll soon appear that he is the Republican senator who may be among the most endangered in seeking reelection. He's from Wisconsin. Wisconsin has voted solidly Democratic in each of the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 presidential elections. He may face a rematch with Russ Feingold, a liberal Democrat who himself was known for doing some oversight. So it'll be interesting to see what he does with that agenda. And many of these committees, many of these legislative committees have oversight subcommittees, either in name or in fact. And those will, I would say, yes, the agendas of those will be some of the most interesting things we'll see in the next 6 months to a year.
Senator Johnson's case is particularly interesting to me because, as I mentioned, he's chairman of this very important committee. There are a lot of folks, including some of the dialogue that you and I had before between the election and the new Congress being sworn in, revolved around the fact that it was unlikely or not out of the realm of possibility that Senator Johnson wouldn't get that committee chairmanship. He does now have it. One of the reasons that I find that so fascinating is because in Wisconsin, at least, he is associated with the Tea Party movement. I haven't seen much talk about that here on the Hill, except to revolve around the fact that he doesn't hang out with Senator Cruz and Senator Lee, who are the other ones who are well known as being associated with the Tea Party. He's taken a different tact, and I imagine that's because he does know that eventually, and now it will be 2016, he will have he'll face the voters again in a place that's not necessarily friendly to Tea Party folks historically. Am I on track there?
You were on track. He's not quite as combative as the Cruz, Mike Lee, wing of the Republican Party is, those are the other Tea Party senators most affiliated with the Tea Party movement. But his voting record is, it is not as though, whether for good or ill, he seems to have been pretty darn consistent to the principles he ran on. His voting record has not shifted towards the center since he got to the Senate. He does not look like a typical, like him or not, like a typical politician who tries to run towards the middle when he knows that's where he needs to go politically.
He did, though, say all the right things about maintaining the bipartisan spirit of that committee. And I came away from that meeting with a sense that Senator Carper, if he didn't believe that he was being sincere about it, he was faking it pretty well.
Yep. I think Senator Carper is a pretty congenial guy, and he's always obviously going to be willing to give to give his new chairman as much of the benefit of the doubt as he possibly can. And, you know, who knows? I don't know it. I don't know enough about, to be honest, about Ron Johnson's long-term strategy to know where it's going to go. You know, as you say, there is kind of a bipartisan vibe on that committee more than on many other committees. There's also generally more of a bipartisan spirit in the committees, especially on the Senate side, than there is on the floor. Generally, the committee folks are often on those committees because they want to solve the problems that are the jurisdiction of those committees. So if you're on the Public Works Committee, I mean, Barbara Boxer, liberal Democrat from California, and Jim Inhofe, famously conservative Republican from Oklahoma, they don't see eye to eye on almost anything except the bread and butter work of the committee that they are the top people on, the Public Works Committee. I mean, they don't see it has two, does two things, public works and the environment. Of course, they're 180 degrees apart on the environment, but when it comes to public works, they sing out of the same hymn book. So this is true of many, many committees up there.
David Hawkins, the senior editor at Roll Call. We are just a couple of weeks away now, about four, from the lapsing of funding for the Department of Homeland Security. Are we seeing any movement in the effort to get that agency funded?
I think that's right. It's 4 weeks from Tuesday. 4 weeks from tomorrow is the 27th. The big debate today is, and the big thing we're trying to figure out without total success here at CQ, is what is Mitch McConnell's strategy for bringing up this bill in the Senate? As listeners know, the House has passed its version of a DHS appropriations bill to last through the end of the fiscal year. It has the immigration riders in it that the president can't stand and says he would veto. Both John Boehner and Mitch McConnell have both hinted pretty strongly that they see a clean DHS funding bill as the likeliest way this is going to end up, but McConnell hasn't signaled yet how he's going to get there. Some of the news from today is that because of several absences from the Senate, four senators are absent this week who support the Keystone bill. That actually means they have less than a filibuster-proof majority to advance that bill any further. So it's been on the floor now for a couple of weeks, but McConnell can't get it over the finish line because he's got four people that he knows he wants to are going to vote for it aren't around. So what that means for the DHS funding bill is that it might open up some time on the calendar to start debating that bill. The question for McConnell is, does he have a full-throated debate, or does he wait for a little while and try and do other things and then wait towards the end of the month, create a little bit of drama, and then say, oops, out of time, the only thing that there's left time to do is pass a clean bill.
So if he, however he chooses to do it, whenever he chooses to bring it up, is it possible that it could work this way? And I'm only talking about the rules and procedure of the Senate, not about the political likelihoods one way or the other. But is it possible that they could bring up the House bill, somebody could introduce an amendment that would strip out all that language, they'd get cloture, they'd get 60 votes to approve it, the bill would pass, and they'd send it back to the House, and at that point they'd essentially say to Speaker Boehner, listen, here's a deal, you can take it or not, and we can be out of this.
That's one way they can do it. There are lots of different ways they can do it. They could take up their own bill. There's nothing to say that unlike with tax bills, which have to start in the House, there's no rule that says a spending bill has to begin in the House.
Do they have time to do that, though?
That would be unless he wants to start doing it now and spend the next 2 or 3 weeks on it, probably not. The procedural way to make this problem run out of time and force a solution is probably to do something closer to what you just described.
One final thing. One of the senators who's absent and not voting that you mentioned a few moments ago is Senator Harry Reid. He's not in favor of Keystone XL, but he is not voting right now. He was scheduled to have surgery today, and you have a terrific column, by the way, on your Hawkins Here blog at rollcall.com. We have a link at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth about Senator Reid. What is the latest on his surgery? He should be finished by now, I think.
The surgery is over just within the last few minutes. Harry Reid's office put out a statement saying that the surgery lasted 3.5 hours, that he was under what they called full anesthesia, but that he's already back at his apartment in the West End at the Ritz-Carlton condominiums, just a couple of blocks from GW Hospital, where the surgery took place. They said the surgery was successful in removing much of the blood from his eye and in repairing the bones around the right eye, which was pretty severely injured in a sort of a freakish exercise accident on New Year's Day. What the statement does say is that the doctors are optimistic about the prospects for regaining vision, but there's no definitive verdict yet, is the quote from his office. So what I was writing about today is just sort of to say, you know, very few people, I mean, Harry Reid is a guy who's had many political lives and even physical lives. He's only won one Senate election with more than 51% of the vote. He has been hospitalized two or three times just in the last 3 years. He's a 75-year-old man who, except for this accident, is in pretty vigorous health. And very few people want to count him out, either politically or physically. He's actually the oldest Democratic leader now of all time. He's verging. He's been doing it now for more than a decade. He's also up in 2016. Very few people want to count him out, but they also say this was a serious injury, and in you know, on the body of somebody less vigorous than Harry Reid, it might be an even bigger deal, and it still may be a bigger deal, as his office hints at that you know they're not promising that he'll get the vision back in his right eye. It is tough to lead that intense a schedule when you're suddenly without the use of half your sight.
This is really an incredible story about him, and you tell it well today. He's lived, you write, through a hospitalization for exhaustion in 2013, a serious car crash the year before, and even an attempted car bombing when he was Nevada's top gambling regulator in 1981. And if I'm not mistaken, his wife has had issues with health in the last several years, too, Landra.
That's exactly right. She is in somewhat frail health. She had her own relatively big deal car wreck as well. He's had lots of challenges throughout his life. You know, I mean, it's somewhat of a fascinating Horatio Alger story of this guy who was born in kind of a shack in a place called Searchlight, Nevada, and put himself made some pin money as a kid as a boxer, and has sort of been onward and upward through. It's a fascinating story. It would make a great movie, The Life of Harry Reid.